Welcome to a podcast for everyone. Practical conversations answering your questions about how to make websites and mobile apps work for everyone. This podcast series is brought to you by UIE's All You Can Learn, Rosenfeld Media, and the Passiello Group. Today, Whitney Quisenberry and Sarah Horton talk to UIE's Adam Churchill about the series.
Hello everyone, welcome to the first in a new series of recordings we're calling A Podcast for Everyone. The concept for this podcast comes from Sarah Horton and Whitney Quisenberry, co-authors of A Web for Everyone, their new book from Rosenfeld Media. Whether you're in charge of the user experience, development, or strategy for a website, A Web for Everyone is sure to help you make the site accessible without sacrificing design or innovation. I'm Adam Churchill, your host for this companion podcast. So a bit about our authors. Sarah Horton is Director of Accessible User Experience and Design for the Passiello Group. She works with companies and product teams to create born accessible digital products and services that work well for everyone. She's also the author of Access by Design and co-author of Web Style Guide with Patrick Lynch. Whitney Quisenberry combines an obsession to communicate clearly with her goal of bringing user research insights to designing products where people matter. Her previous books, Storytelling for User Experience and Global UX, help practitioners keep users in mind throughout the creative process. She's the co-director of the Center for Civic Design. We thought it made some sense to open the podcast series with the authors talking a bit about what they learned putting this book together, the journey of people who will read it, and the plans we have in the works for future podcasts in this series. Welcome, Sarah. Welcome, Whitney.
Hi, Adam.
Hi, Adam.
So, accessibility. It's a huge topic. Can you talk a bit about how you organized it for the book?
Sure. We started off our conversations right away talking about organizing the accessibility topics around guidelines because we personally are very much in favor of working around guidelines and principles. So much so, actually, that early on in our calls, we would have sort of getting to know you calls because Whitney and I knew of each other but didn't know each other well. And we would talk through our different ideas for the book. And on one of the calls, we had this great moment where they were video calls, and I was talking about a particular book that I'm very fond of called The Universal Principles of Design. And so I was saying, oh, I really want to write a book like this. It just lays things out so clearly, and it's so obvious, and there are these great illustrations. And Whitney was like, wait. And it was a video chat, and suddenly she ran off screen, and I'm sitting there going, where did she go? And she comes back, and she has her copy of that book held in her hands. And from that moment on, I feel like we really hit a great synergy around this notion of guidelines as guiding the discussion. And we also wanted to talk a lot about people and have these guidelines really come to life by bringing people into the discussion. So Whitney did a lot of work preparing the personas for the book. And maybe you should speak about that, Whitney.
Sure. I come from actually a theater background, so the idea of making characters is pretty easy for me. But also, I think personas add something that's often missing in discussions about accessibility, which is the people and their lives. I mean, we often think about designing for someone who's blind or designing for someone who's deaf. But we don't think about designing for Jacob. He's a paralegal. He's kind of an equipment geek. He loves new tools. And by the way, he happens to be blind. Blind is the last thing about him in his mind. It's not the only thing we should be thinking about. We should be thinking about everything about the person. And personas are a great way to show that. Now, no set of personas can represent the entire universe of people. I mean, they're many, many different variations of human beings in the world, but we picked 8 of them that we thought represented the kind of range of design considerations that you need to think about when you're thinking about designing for a broad range of people. And they're in the book, they're also on the website, and they really helped us kind of focus on who the audience was, not the audience for the book, but the audience for design, and we hope that they'll help other people as well.
With both your backgrounds, really broad and diverse experience, why accessibility? What was the goal in writing this book, and did that change at all during the process?
Well, I've been working in interaction design and user experience design for, good Lord, a long time. And I have been doing accessibility work sort of in parallel, but haven't brought them together in the way that I think they need to come together. And so one of our goals in writing the book, particularly with the structure that we were using, is to bring universal design principles and accessibility together as an approach to moving forward with building accessible designs. And so universal design is an approach to design that takes into account the needs of everyone in making design decisions. And it's a very attractive way for, as a designer, to look at accessibility so that you're not thinking about accommodating people who are blind or accommodating people who have mobility issues, but rather building a product or a space or a park or a potato peeler that is going to be usable by everyone. And as a designer, that approach to accessibility is very, very attractive because it involves really elegant design solutions as opposed to accommodations.
Whitney, how about for you?
Well, I think that I'm probably pretty typical of a lot of people working in web design and user experience because I thought accessibility was good. Of course we should do it. It seemed like a generally good thing to do. But it wasn't anything I really paid attention to. What got me really engaged in it was actually the work I've done around elections and ballot design. When I started hearing people pit the needs of voters with disabilities against, say, security needs, as though they were in opposition, instead of saying, we are bright, clever, innovative people, and we can do great work that meets both technical requirements and human requirements. And I don't think this is that different than the battles that the early usability pioneers had to say, look, it's great that these computers exist, but let's make them work for humans. The other thing that I see these days in UX is a really deep well of a desire to do good, right? Desire to make things that change the world in positive ways. And, you know, some of us occasionally get to work on big projects. A lot of our work is routine. And I think that one of the nice things about the way we've approached accessibility is that we've said accessibility is part of user experience. If you are thinking about people as you make design decisions, then you're just doing design, but you're doing it for a broader range of people. You're doing it for more people, just like we think about diversity of devices these days, you know, a laptop screen, a big computer screen, a tablet, a small screen. So that's one dimension of diversity. And accessibility is really about how we interact. You know, a screen reader, a mouse, a keyboard, a specialized keyboard are another dimension of diversity. And just including that in our design work from the beginning, rather than saying, right, I finished my design, now let's sit down and make it accessible, what Sarah was calling accommodation, where we kind of layer it on afterwards. And trying to figure out how to help people think about this stuff from the beginning.
You've created what you call the Accessible UX Principles and Guidelines. What is that and why is it important?
Sarah was talking earlier about how we both really like the idea of principles and guidelines. And I think it's because principles are a way of thinking, right? They're a starting point for how you think about it. Too often we think about, well, both usability and accessibility, we think of them as checklists, right? We have to do this, we have to do that, let's check off the things. And trying to shift that to think about user experience principles that broaden out to be accessible. So again, it's about designing it in and about changing the way we think about design rather than just giving us yet another checklist.
Sarah, tell us why Accessible UX? Why is that the name?
Well, when we started the book, we had planned to map accessibility to the universal design principles. And that's what we had proposed, and that was sort of our plan going out the door. And then as we worked on the book, it really morphed into something other than what I think either of us expected at the start. Because we were working with the universal design principles as well as the web content accessibility guidelines and principles and success criteria, we ended up doing a lot of mapping and reshaping and rethinking of these existing guidelines and principles into something new. And in a sense, we reshaped them such that they became a new set of principles and guidelines, which we're calling the Accessible UX Principles and Guidelines. And it was a very organic process that I think surprised both of us a bit at the end, because we hadn't really initiated the project thinking that we would end up with sort of a new roadmap and a new way of looking at accessibility within the context of user experience.
Yeah, I think that's right, Sarah. I mean, I love the principles of universal design, but they're really designed for architecture. They started at thinking about buildings and, you know, things like ATMs on the side of buildings, physical spaces. And digital spaces are different. I mean, there's a lot of overlap between service design, physical design, and digital design, but I think we think about them a little bit differently. And so we wanted to make sure that what we were creating was something that would fit into the process of how digital products are created.
Whitney, can you talk a bit about the big question of who's responsible for accessibility?
Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, the answer is everyone. Of course, I guess that's our answer to everything, is that it's a web for everyone and everyone is responsible. We thought about the big areas. There's kind of that upfront research and design component, sort of planning what it's going to be. There's content, figuring out how it's going to work. You might add interaction to that. And there's the developers. But those are really hard to separate in digital products, because if you design something that's hard to build accessibly, then you end up with something that's kind of kludgy. And if you build something in a way that doesn't express the design well, you end up with something's kludgy. So we really think that it's about making sure that everybody is part of the process all throughout the process, as opposed to just coming in and doing their little piece. Let me give you an example from research. You might just think that user research is pretty neutral, right? We're going to go find people in our audience. We're going to use one of the many, many techniques in our toolbox to investigate them. But to make that into accessible UX, you can ask the question, who's included in the research, right? Are we reaching out to include the voices and the needs of people with disabilities or older adults or children? Are we only thinking about people who are, quote, like us, or have we reached out beyond that, maybe to people who are bilingual or who just happen to be getting old and their eyes aren't as good as they used to be? So when they're included in the research, then their voices are included in our design process. So when we start thinking about teams, then it's a whole bigger question, right? It's not just one discipline. And Sarah, you've done a lot of work helping teams learn how to build accessibility into their overall process. So maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that's definitely a really important aspect of this. The days are gone where you had one person doing everything from soup to nuts. Now we're working on these interdisciplinary teams with different people responsible for different aspects of a project. One thing that was very important to us in the book was to make sure that everyone involved in the product development team understood how the decisions that they are making affect someone else's ability to build and make good decisions that are going to be accessible and provide an accessible user experience. So that was a very important aspect in the book, and one thing that moving forward, if we're actually going to build products with built-in accessibility and born accessible products, everyone has to know how the work that they're doing is going to affect the next person involved in the product. So, for example, if you're building a layout or a design that's going to be difficult for the developers to code in an accessible way, then you need to understand those constraints and build a design that is going to be aided by accessible coding practices.
We know that lots of teams are sort of being faced with this challenge, right? They've never thought about accessibility before, and all of a sudden, for whatever reason, they're being challenged to make their sites and their applications accessible. Sarah, where do they start, and what are some things that they can do that'll have the biggest impact immediately?
That's a really good question, Adam. The one thing I guess I would say is that there are a lot of things that can be done at the code level to make a website or application have technical accessibility in the sense that all of the information that's needed to make an interface functional and usable, a lot of that takes place in the code of a page. And so actually, if a team were to get started, I would suggest making as many fixes to the current implementation of a product to make sure that that underlying code does provide the information necessary. And often design-related adjustments are much harder to make because there's a lot more that goes into that. At least in the work that we're doing, whenever we're suggesting that a team rethink an approach to a design or an interaction, those changes are harder to make and take longer, and there are more stakeholders involved, and there may have been a lot of usability testing that had been done for that particular implementation of a design. So those are harder to make. But the decisions about the code, those you can really just go ahead and implement and only have a positive effect on all users.
Whitney, what about when your clients turn to you? Anything additional that you offer?
Yeah, I want to sort of second everything that Sarah said, but add something else, which is that we often forget about content, right? You know, the stuff in the middle of the page that we came to the site for, whether that's, you know, a product catalog or information. And there's a lot we can do with that. It's harder to change and fix maybe in a built site, a site that's already existing. But beginning to think about content, and this stuff is simple. It's using headings properly, right? A heading helps you find your way through the code. It's the landmarks on the page. It's making sure that the style sheet presents those headings well so they've got good colors. But if we think about headings, if we think about alternative text for images, and we think about making forms accessible, those get you a long way into fixing the content, whether you're going back and cleaning up old content or starting again with new content. And I think that often feels more daunting because many organizations have many different people writing information, and it feels like you have to get a large team going. But that work is really important. Even things like simplifying languages or putting in bullets makes a huge difference to people who don't read very well or are reading on a tiny screen. And they make it easier for people to use the things you put out on their site for them to use.
So, A Web for Everyone, a fantastic resource for design teams. Sarah, can you talk a bit about how design teams are using the book in their work?
Well, one way that people are using the book and that teams are using the book relates to what I was talking about earlier in terms of having everyone understand how the project works together and how decisions are made collectively and how they impact one another. So that's a really important facet of the book because it really highlights everyone's role at the different points in the development lifecycle. Another way that the book is being used, and also we have resources right now on the website and the personas are among them. So I recommend people have a look at those right away because those are personas that you can go ahead and start using to bring people with disabilities into user research discussions. The personas were mainly done by Whitney, and I just have to do kudos to Whitney because I think they are one of the strongest components in the book. And the illustrator is Tom Bybee. He did a fantastic job working with us to get them to be the type of personas that we really wanted to represent in the book and on the website. So the personas are already there for use, and I recommend that folks have a look at them and download them and start using them in your work.
We tried to pack it full of examples and the kinds of things you think about at each different aspect of design. Even though it's principles and guidelines, they're meant to be inspirational, right? They're meant to be things that will help you think about how to do your design better.
So I have to ask this question because it seems to come up, at least here in the United States. There's talk of compliance. As guidelines, should you follow 508 or WCAG?
Okay, so let me explain what those are. 508 is our shorthand name for the U.S. Federal requirements for accessibility, and WCAG stands for the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines from the W3C, which is also a set of requirements and guidelines for accessibility. The answer is that we think you can actually focus on WCAG because the federal government is about to update the 508 regulations, and if they do what they've announced they're going to do, they're going to say that if you follow WCAG, you will be following 508. So we're beginning to see these two really important kind of legal requirements converging. The other thing that we did in the book was we have a crosswalk between the WCAG guidelines and principles and our guidelines and principles so that you can see how the things fit together. For example, there are requirements in WCAG that affect both the visual design and the content design. And so we've got them in both chapters. And you can see how two teams, for instance, might need to coordinate their work in order to meet those requirements.
So at the beginning, we sort of teased all the great plans we have for this podcast. Can you tell our audience what they can look forward to?
Well, first of all, you'll hear a lot less of us and a lot more of other people. I think when we started the book, Sarah hasn't mentioned something in the book that is also important. We have interviews with people who were kind of influential in our thinking, and we want to continue that process. There are a lot of people working in this field doing really awesome work, often developing really interesting tools and techniques that we can use, and we'd like to introduce them to you. So we'll be bringing them in and picking their brains for practical, useful things you can put to use in your work.
Very cool. That's super exciting, and we're looking forward to hearing what you broadcast with us in the near future. So thanks for everyone. Thanks to our audience for listening in, and a special thanks to our sponsors, UIE, Rosenfeld Media, and the Passiello Group for making this series happen. Be sure to follow at A Web for Everyone on Twitter. That's at A Web for Everyone. For information about future A Podcast for Everyone plans and availability. Goodbye for now.
Thanks for joining us for A Podcast for Everyone. This series is a companion to the book A Web for Everyone, co-authored by Sarah Horton and Whitney Quisenberry. Be sure to tell us what you want to learn next at awebforeveryone@gmail.com. This podcast series is brought to you by UIE's All You Can Learn. UIE's All You Can Learn will give you the skills and techniques you need for a competitive design advantage with 24/7 access to UX experts and topics. Rosenfeld Media. Rosenfeld Media offers unequaled UX expertise in print and in person. Their experts consult, teach, and write books like A Web for Everyone. The Passiello Group. The Passiello Group helps organizations make their technology accessible to everyone, including people with disabilities. As always, thanks for listening.